What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Josh Larson. What if they did? Just one year. What if everyone stopped watching?
They won't, Josh.
What if they did? What if we did?
Won't happen.
You root for your favorites, you cry when they get killed. It's sick.
Yeah.
It is sick, but we just keep doing it. No, not watch young people kill each other in the woods, but assemble our top 10 films of the year.
And kill listeners' favorites.
If their favorite is Pain and Gain, then yes, Josh, we will do that. And like The Hunger Games, we're back with a sequel of sorts, part two of our Best of the Year roundtable with Michael Phillips of the Chicago Tribune and The Dissolve, Scott Tobias.
I volunteer as tribute.
Our very favorite films of 2013 are ahead on Film Spotting. You're listening to Film Spotting. This week, it's the best of 2013, The Desolation of Smog. That is part two of our year-end countdown. To hear the first half of our best of 2013 picks, you can visit filmspotting.net or download the show on iTunes. It's episode number 472. And we do welcome back in Michael Phillips from the Chicago Tribune and Scott Tobias from The Dissolve. You guys are looking good. You're looking healthy despite being here at WBEZ for a week. Very little food, a little bit of water. Thank you.
We have 472 reasons to be grateful.
Well, it is great to have you here as always this time of year when we reflect on the year in cinema. And I guess to get us rolling here, as we have already shared on part one of this show, our 10 through 6 picks, we'll get to 5 through 1, but we'll allow one of our Film Spotting listeners to get us rolling. This is Martin Teller. He's a member of the Film Spotting Advisory Board, a very special group on the Film Spotting Forum that helps us out from time to time, Josh. They chime in with great top 5 ideas, massacre theater ideas, and also some of those films. They curate those lists that help us decide on our top fives from time to time. So Martin Teller here, not representing the entire FAB because they couldn't come to a consensus, but representing himself, his pick for the number one film of the year.
Hi, Adam and Josh. This is Martin from Portland, Oregon. And my favorite film of the year is Give Me the Loot, a really fresh and vibrant debut feature from Adam Leon, who I hope to see a lot more from in the future. It has two terrific, charming leading performances by Ty Hixon and Tashiana Washington, both of whom I hope to see plenty more of as well. It's just, it's funny and it's alive and relaxed and one of the most charming and easy films to watch that I've seen in a long time. Thanks a lot.
Give Me the Loot, a movie about graffiti writers and their elaborate plan to bomb the ultimate location, the New York Mets home run apple. That film, unseen by myself and Josh, but that's why we have Michael and Scott here to chime in on Martin's pick. What say you?
Marvelous film. Yeah. I love, it's small, but wonderful.
Yeah, right. You should rectify that. It is a lot of fun, this movie. It reminded me a little bit of Raising Victor Vargas. Back in the day, it has. It's very, very loose and funny and sweet and has a really great sense of local color. I was a champion of this film.
Yeah, me too. Top 30 for me.
Top 30,
you know.
All right.
And when you see 400 a year, you know, that means something.
I had a best first feature for in my voice poll. So
there you go. Mm-hmm. There you go. So Give Me the Loot. Obviously, you guys are on board. And
I financed the picture, Scott.
Yeah, you keep one up.
Of those 400 movies you saw in 2013, Michael, what's your number five?
I financed fully half of them. So it was corrupt.
What is your number five pick?
My number five pick is Fruitvale Station, in fact, directed by Ryan Coogler. That was the docudrama about the Bay Area transit platform shooting and the events leading up to that bloodshed, kind of a day in the life. I thought this was a really, really strong debut from Coogler as a first-time feature filmmaker. And, I really went for this. You know, a few problems, a few indulgences that I think, you know, second or third time filmmaker probably would have thought, meh, that's too much, or I don't need that poetic flourish, or... But I think this thing has just a barreling momentum, and I really went for it.
Yeah, I was not a fan.
Not a fan,
no. And I am not either.
No,
whoa.
No. I think Wesley Morris had a review of it that I think put it well, which is that the film is kind of about, and I'm paraphrasing here, about sort of adjusting the light on his halo.
That's how I felt.
I got to disagree with that. I mean, there are
probably almost as many scenes of him doing questionable things.
Adjusting. Questionable, exactly.
But it's not you know, an angel, but you know, the film kind of,
and most scenes
so
are
much
him.
Happens. And, yeah. The whole thing about the dog. Remember
the dog? The dog is
scene.
One of those instances Michael
is
talking about where you're right.
We're all thinking about the dog. Yes,
wouldn't do that. I mean, that was just come on. But no, the way the halo was adjusted, I think, was rare for movies like this, and I appreciated the scenes that did that. I think about the one in the grocery store where he switches. I mean, he switches in a moment from a threatening figure to one that you hope is closer to who he really is. And it was really fascinating to watch an actor to be able to play all those sides as well.
Yeah, Michael B. Jordan, he's very good. We should say the movie Fruitvale Station. I don't know how much plot you gave there, Michael. I don't think a whole lot, we don't need to. But what we're talking about with the dog as a little bit of a setup, it's about the real life story of a character, a man named Oscar Grant, a young African-American man who was killed in an unfortunate incident, a lot of misunderstanding going on by a Bay Area police officer on a Bay Area transit platform on New Year's Eve. And obviously, based on a true story, a lot of emotions surrounding this, justifiably. And we see that last day, basically, in his life. And I'm with you, Scott. It's a movie that I had a lot of high hopes for. What we see in a dog scene is a scene where he basically is the one person who, in the middle of the day, comes across a dog who is just left in the street after being hit by a car. And it's the most blatant example of foreshadowing that you're ever going to see in any kind of film. And
it's also
heavy.
Like 13 seconds. I mean, and this
it
is
doesn't matter how
feature,
long it is.
So
it doesn't.
To the point of how much it's talked about, though, when this film comes up.
Josh, it's just one. It's just the most egregious example of that, and the most powerful, the most blatantly emotional, calling on your emotions as an audience member to kill a dog in the street and have the character who's going to be gunned down later be the only one who carries him away. I mean, it's very heavy-handed, and I think it just stacks the deck, and I think the whole film does that. I'm with you completely, Scott, that every scene seems to be a scene where we watch Oscar, he just happens to be turning over a new leaf in every aspect of his life on the day he dies.
Well, a little bit. Do you really get the sense from that film that he was a miscreant and just completely misguided?
No, not at all.
The whole way until this day, I didn't get that at all.
No, I don't either.
Nobody's chucking the drugs in the ocean, and it feels like
making a lot of big life changing decisions on that day.
Well, never at any moment did I take this as the literal truth for how this guy was. I think these were all examples of how this was a character, a person in flux, a person who was still growing and trying to find his identity, and was snuffed out just before he was getting a handle on that. And to me, that made it more tragic.
Forced foreboding is the phrase I use. It felt like a lot of that, a collection of that to me. Yeah, and it had enough to go around. It didn't need to force anything.
I'm getting a lot of forced foreboding with the list here. The next picks
great
on the
start.
List.
Dog pile.
Great start to our top five here, Scott. You're number five.
Okay, maybe this will be a more conservative choice. Maybe you'll jump on me, but I don't think so. My number five is Before Midnight, Richard Linklater. This is another just perfect film. You know, the phenomenon with those movies is like every time there's a sequel announced, it's like, no, you don't do it. The last one was just so perfect. And then they do it. It's like, that's great.
So if you're going to spend another 56 more years together.
Yeah.
What about me would you like to change?
That's another one of your can't win questions. I'm not answering that.
What do you mean? There's not one thing you'd like to change about me? I'm perfect?
Okay. Actually,
one thing.
If I could change one thing about you, it would be for you to stop trying to change me.
You are a very skilled manipulator.
Well, I'm on to you. I know how you work.
You think?
Yeah, I know everything about you. Here we go. Let's go through here.
And this is one where you realize that the amount of time these characters have spent together, and you've been there with them, does not even total a day. You know, and they fall in love. And now we catch up with them, and they've spent years together, and they're married, and they have a child. And the consequences of a decision like Jesse, the character played by Ethan Hawke, leaving America, leaving his son behind, you know, those weigh heavily on that relationship. And in this time that they have together, that's supposed to be fun, you know, just the two of them in a beautiful location, all these sort of simmering tensions has kind of come out in a way that's just painfully real and beautifully done by everyone involved.
Where'd you do your time, pal?
Up north.
Club Fed Correctional. White collar. Learned a lot. It's all businessmen.
How many grams of protein you eat?
How you fixed for a job now?
not good. It's kind of hard when you got a record.
I know.
Doesn't feel real good when Mickey D's tells you you're not even good enough to make the French fries.
We all make mistakes. Doesn't mean we have less right to a piece of the pie.
All right, Michael, I backed you up with Fruitvale Station. You're going to back me up with my number five, Pain and Gain.
I know he's not.
Come on.
No, you didn't really see.
What did Godard say about, you know, the best critique of a movie is to make another movie? Well, the best critique of the crass consumerism of Michael Bay movies has been made by Michael Bay. I don't know how much he knows that. Yeah. I think a lot of the great thing about this movie is due to the script, actually, and the performances as well. But I didn't know what was going on and who was responsible for what, but I loved how everything came together in this kind of crazy story of these dim bulb bodybuilders. I think that Mark Wahlberg is totally in on the joke as the lead guy here. They pull off this kidnapping scheme that just goes completely off the rails. And I'm telling you, Bay's bombastic, sort of barely coherent style, which I have not really enjoyed in almost every one of his pictures, it just really serves the movie's underlying, and I think maybe it's unintentional theme, that the new way to live big in America these days is to cheat. You've got to cheat your way to the top. There are no more bootstraps. You got to come up with these schemes and how it blows up in these guys' faces. And that's indicative of Bay's career. I mean, he's cheated his way to the top with these Transformers movies.
He is not the guy to have to exhibit any moral intelligence as a filmmaker to get any laughs out of this thing.
Yeah. So funny. Yeah, I laughed continually through this film.
Look, I financed the film, Jeff.
I don't even like it.
So I do like that. I think we're embarking on an annual tradition here on Film Spotting. What movie is going to make Josh's top five that Adam finds to be the worst of the year? Because you've done it again. Pain and Gain is my number one pick.
For worst of the year?
Yeah, absolutely of the year. And in fact, it's so bad that it makes me really appreciate last year's pick in this moment that we were discussing, Casa de mi Padre. Casa de mi Padre, the Will Ferrell movie. Pain and Gain, by comparison, I mean, it makes Casa de mi Padre look like Annie Hall.
Why didn't you like it?
Okay, so here's the thing. We could get into it. I could sit here all day long and list out all the things that don't work for me about Pain and Gain, but you've already touched on it. I think you touched on the key thing here about why I could not embrace this film and why you did. I read your review, Josh. Your review is really good. If you want to read a much smarter take on the film than the film itself provides, you can read it at Josh's website. Very well argued. But there's two key words in there, and those words are very funny. You found it very funny. Michael, I'm with you. I didn't find it funny at all. Never once. Didn't make me laugh at all. And I think a lot of the problems that people might have with the film, if you find it humorous, if you think it's a funny movie, then you'll probably go with it. But I never did. And I think that's probably the biggest distinction between us. The other thing I'll say that annoys me about the film and annoys me about Bay is that it strikes me as he's a filmmaker with this movie and his style in this movie and the subject matter, where I won't call it offensive because I would never be offended by something that's screaming to be offensive and is so juvenile, which this is. But he strikes me as a filmmaker who wants to be in your face and provocative, or at least have the superficial glare of that he's trying to challenge you. But then he's constantly winking back at you and apologizing, sometimes having characters do things in the moment that are extremely offensive, quote unquote, or should be, and then apologizing for it. It's as if Michael Bay is trying to make a movie that is critic proof. And I'm not talking about critics like us. I mean, nobody can watch it and go, well, look at this, this, and this, and make moral judgments or any kind of judgments about it, because he can always just go, hey, I made a movie with Ken Jeong, the guy from The Hangover, being a self-help guru. Clearly, it's all a big joke. What are you getting so worked up about? He can say that about every aspect of the film. It's like the movie knows it's a big joke, and I don't think that's provocative
at all. But how
is
that to be held against the film? I mean, so many absurd satires.
I would just rather no. But see, I think real satire has the courage of its convictions. It doesn't say, "I'm sorry, I'm apologizing as I'm doing it."
I didn't think that movie even paused to apologize ever. It was very content to be what it was.
It happens a lot.
What scenes have done that?
A key scene would be the one with The Rock, where there's a terrible scene where he beats up a man for coming on to him, shows some homophobia. I'm fine with that, actually, because, you know, bad characters do bad things on screen all the time. I don't judge the filmmakers for that. But then as soon as he does it, A, it's done for a laugh. It's clearly done for a laugh. And then B, he tries to get another laugh by apologizing for it. I'm sorry. The character literally in the moment apologizes. if you're going to go for it, if you're going to have a character who's homophobic and has those kind of issues, just have him do it. Be truly provocative.
Yeah, but that's part of that. That character isn't apologizing on behalf of the movie. That character is apologizing because it's this guy who's a Jesus freak who just got out of jail and immediately signs up for this scheme.
I got that,
Josh.
But
I do think
that is just epidemic of so many moments in the film where he undercuts what he's trying to do.
I don't know that Bay has ever paused to apologize for anything in any of his films.
Well,
and this is the one that seems to be, aware of that independent of itself. I mean, the only reason I could really appreciate this film is to separate it from Bay in a way and see it as a commentary working at some level against his other films. And I really think it does. If you hold it up against Bad Boys or these other pictures that look like this, but this one's turned just a degree, and it's the perfect degree to make it work, possibly against Bay.
Well,
and
it's a lot of work for a viewer to do going in.
I mean, this is the same argument that people that find Spring Breakers really kind of a subversive and very crafty entertainment that kind of turns in on itself. And I don't, I mean, I'm with Adam on this one, I'm afraid. I don't think Bay's the guy to pull this off. And I think the style that he's working in, it doesn't leave any room for kind of a perspective or a deft
it's
enough
all a
touch.
Gag.
A deft enough touch. But
could you say the same thing of The Wolf of Wall Street?
I think
what you're describing is how The Wolf of Wall Street struck me. And I think this goes back to what you're saying, Adam, which is the humor. Because I think if I had laughed more than maybe three times, and it was probably within the first 20 minutes of The Wolf of Wall Street, I might have bought into that thing. Mm-hmm. But after that, I just, really just became repetitive to me. Whereas Pain and Gain, I latched onto the humor right away, and that carried me through. So if it's not going to work for you and make you laugh, then they're almost the same films.
Watching the film,
but why?
I'll say
why
this. You've said a lot of things on the show over the past few years that have shocked me. I mean, some takes on films. Watching this movie and being 30 minutes in and realizing that you were laughing a lot at what you were seeing, I was like, this Josh Larson character, I don't know at all.
You've got to separate it from laughing at what the characters are laughing at and what the movie itself is laughing at. I wasn't laughing along with those characters.
Neither one ever made me laugh.
You didn't think Mark Wahlberg was funny at all in this film?
I don't think Mark Wahlberg's been funny in anything ever. The guy has no sense of humor at all.
He's a far better comedian than he is dramatic actor.
Well, that may
what
be true.
What about Ted? I thought you liked Ted.
Actually, I did like Ted. There you go.
No!
There's an exception.
What?
There's an exception. Scott,
very
weigh
funny
in.
Actor.
Oh, jeez. Well, it really sounds to me, it's like the Pee Wee Herman defense. You know, I meant to do that with this picture, but I
don't
was,
know that he
I
meant
was with
to do
you.
That.
I was with you on Casa de Mi Padre, if you recall.
You can't go this far.
But we no, I cannot. This is not a.
But
film.
It is getting. I mean, it's, I got, like it it's getting some interesting defenses.
But
know?
Can I ding both of you for something? Because you said it here and you said it on American Hustle, which is that these films are not coherent. But that's okay. To me, that's not okay. Like, these are both heavily plotted films that I think would work a whole lot better if they were more cohesive, which they are not. It's a typical Bay problem for me. He has an incredible eye, and he produces these beautiful images that he then proceeds to film into a Cuisinart.
No, I reject that. I reject that analysis. Incredible eye in what way?
I just think his images are just beautiful. They're beautiful images. They're kind of fascist, but they're beautiful. but I think he just cuts them all to shreds. They're punishing.
I mean, I used to think it was all editing room problems with him, and I took a little. I remember being somewhat intrigued by Armin White's observation of why he loves Pain and Gain. That it's all since every angle is a sort of mock heroic low perspective, like shooting up with these sort of grand figures in this Florida sunshine. It all looks a little, as Scott says, it looks like sort of like Nazi recruitment posters, essentially.
And these were all things played for straight in his other movies.
And
it's not here. I mean, how the self-seriousness of every Michael Bay movie until we get to this point. It's remarkable,
okay,
the transition.
Me, okay, you know what I think this is? I think this has got the same light satiric touches like Oliver Stone and Natural Born Killers, another movie I hate.
There you go.
I mean, to me, I just don't think these guys can do comedy. I don't think Scorsese really knows properly finesse the material in Wolf of Wall Street. Oddly enough, we're talking about all these same pictures like it's all kind of one movie. But, here we are. It's the ninth hour we've been taping.
You are listening to the Michael Bay Appreciation Hour. otherwise known as Film Spotting. We were supposed to be sharing our top five films of the year, but we've been derailed a little bit here by Josh's number five pick. We'll get to my number five pick now, which I can't imagine will elicit as much vociferous debate. It is another experimental documentary following my number six pick, which was The Act of Killing. This is Stories We Tell, the Sarah Polley documentary. And this time, we're not working through a cultural or political trauma. We're working through a personal one. I think, Scott, I think you liked this movie, but you lamented this maybe in some comments I saw from you about the movie. And I did, too, during our review, that I don't think Sarah Polley probably needed to spell out quite as clearly what the theme of the movie is and what she's exploring in a movie that it's already called Stories We Tell. And it's very clear to us that she's looking at the power of narratives and how we frame our lives around these narratives. And her father at one point says it as well. He's an actor and he is the narrator within the story. And he's got a great line here I want to read where he talks about when you're in the middle of a story, it isn't a story at all, but rather a confusion, a dark roaring, a blindness, a wreckage of shattered glass and splintered wood, like a house in a whirlwind or else a boat crushed by the icebergs or swept over the rapids and all aboard are powerless to stop it. It's only afterwards that it becomes anything like a story at all when you're telling it to yourself or someone else. I mean, that really is the film in a nutshell as she goes back and investigates an affair that her mother may have had and how she came to being, really, who was truly her biological father. And I think in Stories We Tell, we see how the different participants take ownership of what they perceive as their story. That was one of the things that really stood out to me, and how confusing and splintered, to use her father's phrasing, their recollections are. During our review, Josh, the line I latched onto was one from a character we meet later in the film who says, "You can't ever touch bottom with anything then." He's actually upset about how everybody takes that ownership of this story, and we get all these different perspectives, and they can't focus in and get what he sees as the truth. He's frustrated that everybody seems to have equal say, and there's no authority in this project. And I think that is in some ways maybe the viewer frustration as well, that you can't get to an objective truth of this scenario. But of course, that doesn't really exist anyway. The only truth is the truth of those who are involved. And I think that's what makes this film so fascinating. So Stories We Tell is my number five.
I mean, it's my number four, if you want to transition. So let's go. I'm crazy about it. I have not seen this one a second time. So I don't know, once the narrative surprise element, which is probably, it's just got the most documentary or fiction feature, it's got the most narrative surprise of any film I saw that year. And now that those surprises are known, I'm curious to see how I respond a second time. Didn't felt I needed to see it a second time to just appreciate the feeling I have. It was just this really remarkable kind of inquiry into your own childhood, really, and kind of, and you know, how are your memories of what happened, or how much are they really holding up when you compare them with other family members' perceptions, and then you get these, you know, incredible left turns, and I'm she's really good. Polly's really good.
Yeah, and it's interesting that you say that about the mystery and how it will affect your viewing maybe a second time, because I remember watching it, and of course being really caught up in that mystery and that propulsion of that and wanting to find out who her father truly was. And at the same time, once I finally got there and it was revealed, it's not something I reflect back on the film at all as being one of the more interesting points of the film or something that stays with me at all. It's not what keeps me thinking about that film at all. So
So that's my number four.
There you go.
It's a good pick. I do have those issues with the end of the movie. I feel like there's a certain point where in the last third where the subtext becomes text and the film kind of loses its way. But it's a film I just keep thinking about because you know, just this idea of stories we tell, and about the narratives that people tell themselves, that they tell others, and how tricky that kind of situation.
How they form identity,
different motives, and it's a real thicket of information, and that the film delivers in a very moving way. So that's a good pick.
Your number four.
My number four is Computer Chess by Andrew Bujalski. Andrew Bujalski is known as sort of the inadvertent godfather of mumblecore. He made a film called Funny Ha Ha that sort of started that sort of no budget style where the dialogue has all the fumbling that you hear in real life, and it was a film I absolutely adored. But this is a real left turn from him. It's set in the 80s. He shot it with these Portapak cameras, these tube cameras from, like, what, 1969 or something, ancient cameras to evoke, this specific time and place, which is this hotel in the 80s where these computer programmers are testing their chess programs against each other, and all of these kind of funny, surreal, science fiction-y things that happen in the hotel as they're doing it. And it's just, I don't even know how to describe it. It's just, it's something to see. I don't know if it's a novelty or it's a film that I think it's a wonderful tease of a film and really witty and extraordinarily evocative of the era. I just love it.
Hmm. Yeah, number one film for me that I want to revisit from
right.
The
yeah, definitely worth a revisit. Did enjoy it the first time. There is so much going. It's working on so many different tone mm-hmm. levels from
yeah.
scene to
and
scene.
The ending.
So.
Oh my God, the ending.
Yeah, yeah. Good film. All right, I took way too much time with my number five, so I'm going to make my number four brief, especially because Scott, you had it on your list. Adam, you've already had it on yours. It's the documentary, The Act of Killing. This is a Golden Brick nominee, another one for us here on the show. And I don't know what else, really to say about it, except I remember my jaw didn't drop while watching it, but I remember my head like kind of dropping down as each development, as it took the turn from these face-to-face interviews where they're confessing to then these recreations to the musical fantasy sequences. I just could not believe what I was seeing, especially the fact that it was actual life. It's a really a movie experience I can't shake from this year.
Well, my number four is a movie that, Scott, you stole a little bit of my thunder already, but we're going to let another critic do the honors and announce my pick.
Hey, I'm David Ehrlich. I'm the senior editor over at Film.com, and I'm calling in with my pick for my favorite film of the year, which is Richard Linklater's Before Midnight, the third film that sort of came out of nowhere in a trilogy where the second film sort of came out of nowhere. And for me, the third installment of the story between Celine and Jesse is not just the rare film where we love the characters going into it, but I think it's a great film because we love the characters coming out of it, even if their love for one another is not quite as clear. I think this movie, which splits the difference between Journey to Italy and Scenes from a Marriage and ultimately Contempt, is one of the most beautiful stories of what it means to truly share your life with somebody else. I just think it's beautiful, and you really feel as if the things that they're fighting for at the end, the stakes are very personal to you, as if the decisions that they make or the decisions the things that the film points out about how the relationship works is going to have a very personal effect on how you see your own relationships. And I think while being overwhelmingly emotional for me, will also be a significant touchstone that I return to in years to come. So that was my convoluted and rambling answer to my favorite film of the year. I'm David Ehrlich. And now back to the rest of the show. Goodbye.
Thanks to David for that voicemail. Before Midnight is my number four pick for best film of the year. And I think the phrase I do keep going back to with this movie is I just think of this movie, I think of that whole trilogy really from Richard Linklater as a cinematic gift. For me, that's how I felt being able to experience these movies essentially in real time with the characters. They're a little bit older than me, but not much. And so when you watch all three of these films, I felt like I was reaching some of those same life milestones as we see these characters reach them in the film. As I noted and lamented, I didn't ever have the cool goatee that Ethan Hawke has in the first film, but we can all dream. The fact is, I thought I was maybe special. I thought, I had this special experience. Our generation had this special experience being able to grow up with these films, if you will. The mm-hmm. fact is, we heard in the feedback, Josh, that it doesn't really matter, it seems, what generation you come from. So many people, younger, older even, have watched these movies, come to these movies fresh, watch all three of them maybe in a weekend or over a few week or a few months period, and had a similar reaction to it, have embraced these films. And it's almost as if watching Before Midnight, I feel like Linklater with Hawke and Delpy, who I think at this point, not only because they're writing it, but they're so integral in terms of their performances, you have to see what they're doing as a filmmaking trio. It's almost as if they're making more of an experiment, an anthropological experiment, as we watch these people grow up over the course of these films, that collaboration with those actors. And the fact is, Before Midnight isn't as immediately pleasurable or as enjoyable as the previous two films. The conversations between the characters are a lot less hopeful, and they're more caught up in the mundane issues of being husband and wife and people who are together for a long time that they face. But I still found that central pair to be as fascinating as ever. I also think Linklater probably doesn't get enough credit for how beautiful these films are. I mean, it helps when you're shooting in Paris and Vienna and you're shooting here in Greece.
But very unassumingly, too.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, 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 but there are some great tracking shots, great sun-drenched vistas that
Eric
you get.
Romer. Touch.
There
yeah,
is.
Exactly. Romer, no doubt. Yeah, you never noticed Romer's technique. Mm-hmm.
And I like the fact that this movie basically begins with a 5 to 10 minute long take that's a static shot of them in a car having a conversation that's as natural and believable, for lack of a better word, as any conversation you'll ever see a husband and wife have on screen.
So he and Melina were a real thing.
Yeah.
What's going to happen now?
I don't know. They must be friends. Facebook, you know, they'll keep in touch at least for a while.
What if they end up spending their whole life together? You know,
you're so corny. Sometimes no, I'm just like, are you? What are you? No, a 12-year-old girl? I mean, first love? Do you even remember who it was?
Yeah, I do. It was you.
Oh, please, like you're a virgin at 23.
No, you said first love, not first sexual experience. Okay.
Okay, fine. Yeah. Like, I'm the first woman you've ever fell in love
with. Yeah, pretty much.
I don't
the
think
first
so.
One I felt truly connected to. Sure. What? Okay. I wasn't your first love.
No, of course not.
Oh.
I think it's Ethan Hawke's best performance from the three films. I really like Julie Delpy as well. Josh, we did discuss in a little bit of bonus content recently how maybe the Celine character is written in a way that unfortunately comes across as a little bit too shrill and too irrational at times. She actually does kind of fit the bill that Jesse is putting on her, but she's still a fascinating character. And for me, I say, you know, let's seven up this thing. Let's just come back to these characters every 9 or 10 years. Why not? I'll take before the before brunch, before the early bird special. I'm fine
well,
with
you
that.
Know, and on that front, too, in defense of that character of Celine, is that's the woman he fell in love with. I mean, that's her. She's mm-hmm. she, and that's him too. They're prickly characters, and I think I think as romantic as those first two films are, you can sense that a long term relationship between these two characters is just going to be contentious. They're complicated, intellectual, you know, fiercely independent minded people, and.
I think he's a serious narcissist.
Well, there's that too.
There's no doubt.
She calls him on that.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think, in fact, I read it the other way, Adam. I find him less sympathetic. But it's partly, I think, it's the reason I like this film and didn't love it like the first two. It has something to do with just the fact that it's, you know, it's a more abrasive picture and they're in a sadder point in their life together.
Without a doubt.
But it's also just a matter of, I think, Ethan Hawke, yes, it's his best work, these three films. I think he's just simply an actor of moderate invention and creativity, and I think she is 50 times more interesting.
I love Ethan Hawke as an actor.
No kidding.
I think the difference between Ethan Hawke.
What about in Getaway? Getaway?
No, that's it. He's fine, but in Sinister, he's terrific. But like, I think he's an actor who's gained so much with age, has gotten so much deeper and so much more. Interesting to me.
Well, I think here,
you know what he's getting. I mean, if Linklater can get the most out of that guy, and what you really do get out of this film is that, like, so much this year, and maybe this is why it was a good year. Alexander Payne, you know, again, a film I liked, didn't love. Nebraska, liked it a lot. But if this, I mean, these are people who Linklater's, you know, Bernie, me, and Orson Welles. These three films. I mean, this guy has. Amazing range. He's never made a film that wasn't worth seeing yet, and you can say the same about Payne and about a half a dozen other people this year. That mm-hmm. that was a good film.
Well, I'll just cap the discussion by saying about Hawke, I'm with you in that I think he gets better with age because I think you're seeing that he is less reliant. He can't rely anymore on that boyish charm and that smile that works so well in the previous two films, and here he is devoid of vanity, and I think he embraces it, and I think that works. But Michael, I do want to say I'm with you completely. That's my problem ultimately with the Celine character. Is that I do think Jesse is by far the less sympathetic character. It's unfortunate that certain elements about the way I think Celine comes off all of a sudden starts to tip the scale too much in his favor. I think that she is by far the more sympathetic character, and yet something about the way she's portrayed just evens it out too much. Mm-hmm. So that's Before Midnight, my number four pick, and we are now at number three. Michael.
A film I need to see a second time, but I loved it the first time enough to put it number three. Consuming Spirits, directed by Chicago's own Chris Sullivan. It's an animated feature unlike any I've seen about a town's secrets that are kind of percolating under the surface of this very mundane, just sort of, you know, daily life. Fascinating picture, and it took him, I think almost two decades or more to make. Does anybody know the backstory on this? See this film, guys. It's just Chris Sullivan is a, if he never makes another movie, and he took him, let's assume it took him 20 years to make this one, it was worth the time, and it's just, it's one of the most interesting animated films I've seen in years. Consuming Spirits. That's it. I'm not going to tell you any more about it.
Okay, I don't need to hear more. I'm riveted.
It's a kind of a labyrinth of stories and, you know, motives going on among all these characters, but it's just between the pictorial style and this sort of very glancing kind of mastery of a lot of different narrative strands. It's really cool.
I'm sorry I missed it, because I would say this hasn't been a very good year for animation otherwise. I mean, I know I have an animated pick with The Wind Rises already on my top 10.
That's the one film I missed this year.
Oh, okay.
I didn't see that.
But yeah, it's good to hear about another animated one that is, because I think especially some of the major studio animation has been disappointing this year.
I'm with you on that, absolutely. I mean, Frozen, you know, pretty good, but that's about as best. And in some of the stuff, like Pixar's, like Monsters University.
Yeah.
Which is
Despicable Me 2 topped the box office for the year, so you're wrong, clearly, Michael.
Beautiful.
Yeah, where can I see this film?
You know, I don't know. I honestly don't know. I'm never the guy to go to for.
But was it saw it was a Siskel Center?
It was at the Siskel. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was. You know, he's on staff at the School of the Art Institute, I believe, still. And it's to me, it's almost as inventive and sort of bracing as the early work I saw from the brothers Quay. You know, it's got that same kind of like whoa, you know. And when I saw like the Quay brothers' Streets of Crocodiles way back in the 80s, I mean that was just like, this is a whole new sort of niche for animation. I don't know if this is quite to that degree, but it's really remarkable.
Well, it wouldn't be Michael Phillips' top 10 list if he didn't have at least three movies I hadn't seen. So
there you go.
Congratulations,
there
you hit your quota.
I haven't seen him either. To be fair.
To
be fair.
Minor details.
Scott, you're number three.
My number three is Inside Llewyn Davis by the Coen brothers. This is a movie, as I said in the previous broadcast, where I heard some songs from the movie, and it just planted a seed, and it just is a film that just keeps growing and growing and growing in my mind, and maybe the second viewing will show that I've deluded myself, much like someone in Stories We Tell. But it's such a sad film, and such a true film and a soulful film, and one in which you mentioned in the earlier broadcast about Llewyn Davis, you know, was it just not his time? Or did he have bad luck? But there's also the element of like, where you make your own luck. And like,
he's his own worst enemy.
Exactly. Exactly. In the interplay, you know, and I think what fascinates me about the movie, and I think Tasha Robinson, who's my colleague at The Dissolve, really nails this, is that he's so difficult and abrasive to the people who care about him or don't care about him, who are around him. But then there's this need to connect that comes out through the music. Like there's real heart to it, and that's where it gets expressed, and it's breathtaking. I really love this movie.
Yeah, when I came out of it, I thought it might actually be the bleakest Coen brothers picture, and softened a bit though as I've thought about it, and when I finally got around to writing about it, I could see sort of that underlying hopefulness that might be there, or at least is there in the music and the art, possibly, or the pursuit of the art. I'm glad we'll get a chance to talk a little bit more about it, Adam. My number three, though, is Enough Said, going back to one of your earlier picks. Mm-hmm. I didn't have the problem with the plot contrivance, even though I recognize it as one, because I think this movie is just so wise and so funny in an unassuming way that it could make that plot contrivance work for it, to the point where it felt necessary for me by the time this relationship between Julia Louis-Dreyfus and James Gandolfini has hit these complications. It needed something like that to really test them and take them to another place. That first date is great, and I really didn't need anything more than that. I could just watch that first date go on and on and on. But the movie does eventually hit that other level, and it really comes upon this somewhat radical observation for the genre of romantic comedy, I think, and it's that – this idea of that how we love someone could possibly be more important than who we love. You think about romantic comedies are always focused on that guy or that girl. And if we could just get them, we'll be happy.
Well, yeah, there's never any sense of like the work you need to do.
The work you need to do or how that work should look. I mean, if you're gonna love someone generously, that's going to be very different than if you're going to love them suspiciously. And this movie just is wonderful how it works around that question.
Can I throw out a theory here? I have a theory about this movie and why it's so resonant, at least in the moments where it works, which is that, well, all of us, we are men of a certain age, I would say, of some experience. Does that play into your reaction to this film? Because I just felt like this film connects, you know, it's about middle age, and it connects to certain feelings about love and about the way that we relate to each other. And there's a certain tenor to this film that is so particular that I almost don't think if I saw this film 20 years ago, I would have appreciated it as much as I do.
I think
now.
That experience is probably a part of it, because I think such a big part of the movie is clearly the Julia Louis-Dreyfus character is trying to insulate herself against any type of pain whatsoever. Like, she doesn't want to go down a certain path. She doesn't want to be hurt again. So she's going to try to ward that off however possible. And I think that maybe you do have to be a certain age and a certain experience to have gone through that.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I mentioned with Before Midnight, that seems like a movie.
That's what I was
similar characters
thinking.
Who are middle age and dealing with those problems. And yet everybody seems to connect with that.
Those
film.
Listeners we heard from who were teenagers or in their 20s and are now relating to Before Midnight, and they have yet to experience some of those relationships. I feel like Enough Said has that sort of honesty to it as well, that it really would resonate.
Just kind of, and there's some very crafty. I mean, I have a huge problem with the central narrative contrivance of the film, which is why I like it, don't love it. But I mean, the things I love about it, Gandolfini's amazing, and it's like this is a wonderful film for him to have. Shot, and completely finished, months before he died, and so people can really remember now that he had such a wide range beyond Tony Soprano. And,
yeah,
you know, there's other work coming from him, I know, but I think the unstated and the thing in the screenplay, which I think is also kind of giving it a little resonance, Scott, is you have, you know, this is an L.A. story. Right. I mean, this is L.A. You don't really make a lot of the setting, but you know that is a very, very looks-centric culture. You have the Dreyfus character, who is a yoga instructor, and or
is a masseuse.
I'm sorry, masseuse. I'm sorry.
McKeener is the
I'm sorry, masseuse. And part of the it's sort of gently stated in the script, but you know you have kind of a. You know, you have this sort of stunning, 45-ish, 50-ish female, and, this sort of a less classically, we get kind of a schlubby guy of the same age. And, but the movie doesn't get all hung up on the looks thing, except just in a little bit of dialogue here and there.
It's underneath, as it has been in almost all of Hol of Senior's pictures.
Yes.
I mean, she's very attentive to body issues.
Yes.
And one of the great things why I think this movie is elevated a little bit is that she's flipped that. By making that character with those issues, the man, and I think it's fascinating how that plays out and how they do address it in their relationship.
Yeah, it's also very clever too, and I look forward to seeing this again. It's very clever about how certain personalities, a lot of it, and this is not a gender issue. Certain personalities, like in this case the Gandolfini character, you know, they're just like, look, take it or leave it, which is refreshing in one way, but there's also a serious limitation if you sort of just use that as an excuse not to actually put your back into a relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, none of this, again, this is not a thesis point movie. It's it really is a romantic comedy about and for people who aren't 19, which is nice,
Eva was just telling me that there are no men at this party that she's attracted to.
Okay. I don't know why you would make that announcement.
Really?
But,
is that unusual?
No, actually. To be honest, it's not unusual. No offense.
No, that's okay. It's okay. There's no one here I'm attracted to either.
Okay. All right. Yeah, it's kind of an ugly crowd, really.
Jason, you've got a kid in college now, right?
Two.
Yeah, I have one leaving in the fall.
Oh, I do too.
That's all I have.
Me too.
Come on, guys. Your kids are supposed to go away, right? I mean, that's healthy.
No, shut up.
Yeah, shut up.
My number three film of 2013, I think, based on what I've heard, some of it here on the show from my co-host, is one of the most misunderstood movies of the year. I also think it's one of the most underappreciated movies of the year, and I guess we'll find out when we hear the reaction as I say the title. Scott, I think you may be the only one who can help me out here, and I'm not even confident of that.
Hit me.
It is Steven Soderbergh's side effects.
Okay.
That's not what I was after.
Well, that's my reaction, too. I mean, it's not a terrible movie.
It's not what I was after.
It's just being wildly overrated in certain circles.
I like it.
Oh, okay.
It doesn't mean it's bad.
I'm trying to balance it out since it's so misunderstood and underappreciated.
This is like, you know, in Llewyn Davis, when Bud Grossman, played by F. Murray Aaron, just says, I don't see a lot of money here.
Well, yeah. And that's a big part of the movie. I think it's the best movie about the American dream and spoiled brat entitlement and excess that was made in 2013. And as we've touched on in the previous portion of this show, that was a dominant theme this year. It somehow, though, wasn't mentioned in A.O. Scott's tie for his number 10 pick with the likes of much lesser films like Pain and Gain and The Bling Ring and The Great Gatsby.
Wait a minute, what did he have at number 10?
Yeah.
Did you say Pain and Gain?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay.
I did. You know, he isn't perfect. Josh, what are you going to do? I've heard Side Effects described as a glorified Law & Order episode, which makes me want to light myself on fire because it so blatantly ignores what Soderbergh is doing with
the camera. There's nothing in the style that would suggest
but some people go there anyway. I had one listener write in actually suggesting that the ending was falsely hopeful when I'll say non-spoiler, spoiler alert, it's the most cynical ending I saw in any movie this year. There's nothing hopeful, false or otherwise, about it. I've heard many people praise how great the first half of the film is when it seems to be all about a depressed housewife and the perils of pharmaceuticals, but then argue that the second half gets too muddled and it gets too caught up in all the crime stuff, and that the two halves just don't really add up to a satisfying whole. I couldn't disagree more. I think the pharmaceutical stuff in part one is all just a setup for what comes in part two. It tells the complete story I think Soderbergh is interested in telling, which is about what happens when you don't get the life you think you deserve, when you don't get that perfect life, when your reality isn't matching your fantasy. How far will you go to reclaim it? And it just so happens that he gives us multiple characters that go down that path. I think actually one of the Spring Breaker girls in that film, they're going to grow up to be Rooney Mara's character in Side Effects.
I didn't know who he was or what he did. He was just this guy in a suit. Watched me while I made drinks, and it made me really nervous. And he stared at me like I was a painting. He had this beautiful sailboat, and he took me out on it, taught me how to ski. He swept me off my feet.
For me, Soderbergh is a master at diving into processes and the intricacy of processes, and I love how in a lot of his films, everybody has an angle. Everybody's pushing an agenda, and everybody is guilty. It's really just all about whether or not you can get away with it. Nobody is redeeming in this movie, and maybe that's why some critics and audiences probably didn't embrace it. I'm a cynical bastard, though, and I bought it.
I just wonder, it's funny, but if to the degree the numbers tell any kind of story, you know, do audiences, they don't necessarily consistently demand a rooting interest or this and that, but, you know, films as different as that and Pain and Gain both kind of hit their modest and sort of disappointing numbers. And you wonder if that's not the reason. Is it just that this sort of like parade of venality is simply too much or not enough for people? Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if I'm going to back you up, I should mention the couple things I really liked about the movie. One is that it did junk what you thought it was going to be, that you thought it was going to be at the perils of – you thought it was going to be an expose of the evils of the pharmaceutical industry, and then it just throws all that away. I love that. And I feel like the film is it's pretty metatextual. It's Soderbergh at his being wonky, and I kind of like the wonky Soderbergh of Haywire a little bit more, which felt even more like an abstract exercise. But
sure.
But I'm eager, just based on what you're saying about this film, to revisit in that context, because it's a brain teaser of a movie, and I think it really kind of might reward a revisit.
Why is Slate's Dana Stevens one of the smartest critics out there? Well, because her top 10 list shares 4 of the same titles as mine.
Well, what does it say then that she shares 6 titles with me, Josh?
You win. We have a voicemail from Dana talking about one of those films next as our best of 2013 countdown continues.
In the break, you're going to hear 2 of the best soundtracks of the year, according to our friend and movie music aficionado Sam Smith, Ride Home by Skrillex from Spring Breakers, and an excerpt from Shane Carruth's Upstream Color Score. Stay with us.
Jesus. Hi, this is Todd Haynes, director of I'm Not There, and you're listening to Film Spotting.
Hey there, Film Spotting. This is Allison Wilmore and Matt Singer from the Film Spotting SVU podcast, here to tell you our favorite films of the year. Matt, what's your pick for the best film of the year?
My pick is Short Term 12, a really beautiful indie about the employees and the residents of a foster home for troubled teenagers, and also about the art that they create to express themselves. The great film critic Roger Ebert, who passed away earlier this year, he had this quote that I've been thinking a lot about lately, Allison, about how movies are the most powerful empathy machine in all the arts. And that's kind of what Short Term 12 really hit for me. It's such a great example of that. It brings you into these people's lives. It lets you understand what it feels like to live at this place or work at this place, and it's just so incredibly moving. And I've seen the movie several times already. Whenever anyone would ask me to recommend a movie from this year, that's the one I would pick, so it's got to be my favorite of the year. How about you?
Well, I've actually been stuck at home with an injury the last 2 weeks, so I've had the frustrating experience of missing out on a lot of the big movies that get packed into the end of the year. So with that caveat, I would like to say that I think 12 Years a Slave is the best film I've seen of the year. And I know I'm not alone in that opinion. It's certainly one of the most praised, but it's just that the divide between it being such this hauntingly beautiful movie about such a terrible moment in history and about such kind of unflinchingly awful things is just so powerful. And it does, I think, maybe also make for an interesting testament to the benefit of an outside point of view of Steve McQueen, who is not from the US, and that taking on such a kind of shameful moment in our history. I think it's pretty remarkable.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Josh Larson. I'm Adam Kempinar. Scott Tobias from The Dissolve and Michael Phillips from the Chicago Tribune are here with us, as they usually are at this time of year. We're sharing our top 10 films of 2013. You heard on this part of the show, it's a big two-parter. You've heard our 5 through 3 picks. We are going to get to our picks for the top 2 films of the year here in a moment. But we go back to that voicemail you just heard from our colleagues at the Film Spotting SVU podcast, Matt Singer and Allison Wilmore. Allison with her number one film of the year, 12 Years a Slave from Steve McQueen. Matt Singer with a movie a little bit more off the radar, if you will, not one I've seen on a whole lot of lists, Short Term 12, a movie he did quote, you heard in the voicemail, Roger Ebert talking about movies being the most powerful empathy machine in all the arts. And that was a movie that had a huge impact emotionally on Matt Singer. It also happens to be a movie that is one of our Film Spotting Golden Brick candidates. The Golden Brick goes back a few years now. We try to highlight a movie that we consider to be overlooked. Often it's a movie from a young or emerging filmmaker, and we usually like to highlight movies that are formally inventive or at least taking some creative risks. So Short Term 12, one of those choices. We'll read you the other 5 finalists here, and I suppose it's hard to call them overlooked when a few of them have already gotten mentions here in our top 10 show, but we wanted to know which of these Golden Brick finalists gets your vote for overlooked movie of the year. Number 1, The Act of Killing, the documentary from Joshua Oppenheimer. Beyond the Hills, Christian Munju made Josh's top 10. Prince Avalanche from David Gordon Green. Short Term 12, Matt Singer's pick. Or Sarah Polley's Stories We Tell, the movie that was my number 5 movie of the year and Michael Phillips' number 4. Josh, what did the listener say?
Well, does the last place title mean it's still the most overlooked?
Yeah, I guess
really
it does.
Should be the winner.
It should win.
All right. Well, looking at it that way, then Prince Avalanche would be that film. It received 13% of the vote. Beyond the Hills, right there with it, 14% of the vote. Short Term 12, Matt's pick, received 19%. Up at the top here, we have Stories We Tell in second place with 25%, which means The Act of Killing, which has gotten a lot of attention here on the show, 29% of the vote.
Yeah, maybe not a surprise. I thought those docs would probably be at the top of the list. 2 movies we certainly champion here on the show, and that's another criteria for the Golden Brick, though. We got this from listener Joel Rackle in Edmonton, Alberta. He says, there's only one true answer to who should be this year's Golden Brick winner. It's not Stories We Tell, which received an Academy Award nomination last year. It's not Prince Avalanche, which has star power and a direct who has made both indie darlings and big budget comedies. It's not Beyond the Hills, which won awards at Cannes and whose director won the Palme d'Or not long ago. It's not The Act of Killing, which has gotten rave reviews, a lot of attention at year-end time, and will get an Oscar nomination. The true Golden Brick is Short Term 12. From an almost unknown director with actors in breakout roles, unlikely to get a lot of year-end list attention, but great nonetheless. I think he just really shamed us actually with our finalists for the Golden Brick.
That's a movie that just really grabs people by the heart for sure.
Yeah, but he does note the other four nominees basically being not great candidates for the Golden Brick because it turns out that they're movies that have gotten a lot of attention.
Can you defriend them? Or?
I'd like to. Okay. I'd like to because Joel just made us look really bad. But, you know, it's worth noting. I think we should just say this at this point. We've had a lot of conversations behind the scenes about what the Golden Brick means and probably taking it all way too seriously because it's an award that only we probably really care about and some of our listeners. But we are rethinking it. Is that fair to say, Josh?
Yes, we are.
We're rethinking how to approach the Golden Brick.
But we rethink it every year, so I don't really know how this is any different.
I don't either, but we've got a plan in place. The whole goal was to highlight overlooked movies, truly overlooked movies of the year. And you can always debate how overlooked some of these films are, especially if they're getting love from some of us here on the show and other critics. So it's something we're going to continue to refine. We may turn it over, the process, a little bit more to listeners as we move forward. That's something we'll address next year. We'll announce the final winner of the Golden Brick at our live show, the Film Spotting Wrap Party, on January 11th. We hope you will join us at the main stage. Tickets are available now for that. Michael Phillips will be there. We're going to try to convince Scott to show up, as well as some of his colleagues from The Dissolve. Keith and Nathan made the trek to the main stage last year. It was great to have them there in attendance.
They got smashed.
Yeah, of course they did. God. Well, you know, you can't take them anywhere.
You can't take them anywhere, right?
Tickets, as we said, available. Just go to filmspotting.net or mainstage.com. Also at our website, filmspotting.net, is where you can vote in our weekly poll questions. Thanks to everyone who voted in the Brick poll. We hope you'll go over and participate in this week's, where we're reflecting back, as it makes sense on this show, our Best of 2013 show, on some of the movies that were big box office hits. And we're asking you, which of these 2013 hits would you most like to see make some best of lists? So sometimes us snobby, pretentious critics don't have a lot of real mainstream fare on our lists. And we're curious if there are some of these movies that were big hits with the public. Maybe they should be appearing on more lists. So, Josh, the options we're giving them are
a couple of really good titles on here, actually. Hunger Games: Catching Fire was the number 3 earning movie of the year. Fast and Furious 6, which was number 7. Star Trek Into Darkness came in at number 9. And then World War Z, I like that one quite a bit, came in at number 10. The horror movie The Conjuring at number 17. And then Adam's favorite, Pacific Rim, number 28.
So you've heard the options, Michael and Scott. You can sway our audience. You can help determine how this poll comes out. Michael, your pick from those options
would be The Conjuring.
Really?
Oh, yeah. That was in my top 25, 30 easy. And it was just wonderful to see a horror movie treat so much of the familiar haunted house stuff like it had never been done before. And just with a really great fluid, gently 70s sort of inflected stylings, you know, a little bit of all, you know, there's certainly an Altman flavor to the way the sort of camera slip slides around and just lets you see things out of the corner of your eye. Very clever. And I'm eager to see it again, actually. Yeah, you don't usually say about horror films.
Yeah, The Conjuring would be my choice, too, in a walk.
There you go.
Let's see. I'm going to try to choose between Hunger Games and World War Z. Hunger Games, I actually had the first film on my top 10 list last year, so let's mix it up a little bit. I'd say World War Z. Really enjoyed that.
Okay. Well, though ignorance has never stopped me from weighing in before, I'm going to recuse myself because I haven't seen half of the options. I still haven't seen the Hunger Games movie or The Conjuring or Fast and Furious 6. So my opinion matters even less here than it normally does, and we want to know what you think. Your opinion does matter. You can vote now at filmspotting.net.
This is Dana Stevens, a movie critic at Slate and a longtime friend and fan of Film Spotting. I've been on the show a few times, and I hope to be on it again in 2014. So for my best film of 2013, this is a really tough exercise you guys impose on people. No top five, no runners-up, just boiling the entire year down to one title. So this was a very strong year at the movies, as I'm sure many of your contributors are saying, and I'm not just saying that cheerleader style. I didn't say it last year, I didn't say it the year before, but 2013 really was something special. But if I really scan that top 10 list and try to come up with just one title that did it all, that had a superb ensemble cast, beautiful black and white cinematography, a wonderful, spare, tuneful, original score, a profound but also extremely funny script, and the most innovative direction, I think I have to hand it to Alexander Payne's Nebraska. It's a movie that I think utterly succeeds at what it sets out to do and that doesn't have a wasted detail or moment in it. So Alexander Payne's Nebraska is going to be my best film of 2013. And thanks for asking. Keep on doing what you do.
Our friend Dana Stevens from Slate helps us get back into our countdown of our top 10 films of 2013. This is part two. You've heard our top eight picks so far. We have two more left. You heard Dana's there. Nebraska, Josh, did make your list.
That's right.
In that 6 through 10, the new film from Alexander Payne, Bruce Dern there, the star, along with Will Forte of SNL fame, and a film that does seem to be connecting with a lot of critics and a few audiences as well at this time of year. Our thanks to Dana for sharing her pick. Let's get back to our countdown. Michael, what's your number two?
It's been said a few times, but 12 Years a Slave was my number two. And, you know, really, again, with sort of a simple coin toss, it might have been number one. I think it's Steve McQueen's best film by a mile. And I haven't really strongly responded to the previous films. I admired Hunger and to a lesser degree Shame. But I think here there's something just unerringly right about McQueen's visual approach to this material based on the 1853 Solomon Northrup memoir about this freeborn African-American citizen who gets kidnapped, and then, you know, his life for 12 years, obviously, it goes into a kind of Dante's Inferno, Ninth Ring of Hell.
Stop! Stop, you're waiting! You let yourself be overcome by sorrow, you will drown in it.
Have you stopped crying for your children? You make no sounds, but will you ever let them go in your heart?
They are as my flesh.
Then who is distressed? Do I upset the master and the mistress? Do you care less about my loss than their well-being?
Master Ford is a decent man.
He is a slaver.
Under the circumstances.
Under the circumstances, he's a slaver. But you truckle at his boot.
No.
You luxuriate in his favor.
I survive. I will not fall into despair. I will offer up my talents to Master Ford. I will keep myself hardy till freedom is opportune.
Oh, Ford is your opportunity.
So much of the material we've seen in the movies that had anything to do with slavery is such natural bait for the worst kind of melodrama because somehow, you know, the events are miserable enough to entice it, I guess, and entice people into kind of just giving too much to the material. This McQueen's way of not distancing the viewer from what's happening, but in fact just sort of quietly but remorselessly just sort of boring into what's actually happening. And the scene that everybody keeps talking about, which really is perhaps the scene of the year, is this botched hanging that the character played by Chiwetel Ejiofor has to endure. And it just simply gives you a sense of the kind of terrifying everydayness of the injustices and just life and death sort of passing like it's just sort of something floating in the breeze. I don't know. This film really, you know, is it going to open up a conversation on race in America the way some critics predicted a few months ago? I don't know about that. I'm just really more concerned about people going to it. I've heard a lot of people reluctantly saying, I don't really feel like I can put up with it. I don't feel like I'm ready for it. It just feels like medicine. I think those people are in for a surprise because it just it's got the visual quality of it and the remarkable work by Ejiofor, everybody from Paul Giamatti to this amazing actress Lupita Nyong'o, who should damn well get the supporting actress nomination for her role as the slave Patsy. I mean, it's just great work all around.
Well said. Scott, you're number two.
My number two is Upstream Color, the long-awaited follow-up film to Primer by Shane Carruth. And to me, the film is sort of the realization of the digital dream. I remember there's a kind of a famous bit in the documentary Hearts of Darkness where Francis Coppola talks about this future in which, I think he says, like a fat girl from Ohio could just come out and deliver some sort of a masterpiece, something that's just going to blow your mind. And you know, this is a film that Hollywood had nothing to do with. This is Shane Carruth, writer, director, producer, composer, editor, co-editor, actor, working in Dallas, doing everything himself and doing it digitally on a budget that I can't imagine is very, that he's been coy about, but I can't imagine isn't very much. And it is a gorgeous film. It is a very personal film. It's enigmatic. It's a film that you sort of intuit your way through. I'm not even going to try to describe what the plot of this thing is, because let's
talk about the pigs. Yeah,
something about the pigs.
It's about there's a bioengineered grub, and you know, I think it's a story about, I think, you know, thematically maybe you could talk about it as being a film about intimacy, but I just think it's a grand, audacious vision and a true independent film.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and the way you describe it, if people aren't familiar with it, they're probably thinking of this low budget thing scrapped together, but no, this is one of the most elegant and mm-hmm. sumptuous looking movies of the year as well. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, without a doubt.
Very distinctive.
Kruth is supremely talented. I think that comes through whether, to speak to your point, Josh, whether you ultimately get into the film or not, or find it too abstract and enigmatic, I think
it
you
is
see
abstract.
The talent on display there. So great pick. Josh, you're number two.
For my number two, I'm going to echo both Michael and Scott with 12 Years a Slave. And I think, you know, Scott, you talked about it being bold in the earlier show, and it's certainly that. I mean, it's just wrenching as this historical dramatization, but it's equally compelling to me as a consideration of how we watch these dramatizations of past atrocities. You touched on this too, Michael. It's doing something different than other ones have before. And I think this has to do with the boldness. It has to do with the filmmaking style. When Chiwetel Ejiofor looks directly into the camera at one point, and there are other moments where characters do this in the film, I think that's just representative overall. The movie does that in other subtle ways too. What it's doing is it's breaking the fourth wall, obviously, but it's especially important to do that with this subject matter and in this sort of film, to cut through the melodrama, to cut through the safety we have as viewers in the seat where history is back there and it happened long ago, and it's putting us more in that action. And that's not to say, you know, to touch on your wondering about race relations and race conversations, that's not to say that it's always doing this in an accusing way in this film. There may be some of that, but really it's more of an invitation is how I found it, to experience this oppressive history with that safety of the fourth wall removed.
My only question about 12 Years a Slave is the same question that comes up with a lot of movies with this actor. Is what is Brad Pitt doing in this movie?
You know, it's not his problem. It's the screenplay's problem. Mm. He's perfectly fine. How
a better
he
actor could sell those lines.
Alfre Woodard has the same problem in her scene.
Except
the
she's a really talented actress, so she makes it work. Brad Pitt is not, and he can't make it work.
It's just too explicit. They're talking about things
everything
that
about
they
the
should
way that
not
scene,
be talking about.
I agree with you completely, but it's overwritten.
It's like Scars and Fine Leather. That's yeah, Brad Pitt's performance in this is great. It doesn't affect it. Gives it some sort of something.
Something.
But
there is something.
But you know, the movie is so cold to the touch. That's the Steve McQueen thing. It's just like, it's so unblinking. He's just going to show you how it goes. And the film is just full of, you know, when you really dig into the supporting characters, the slave owners played by Benedict Cumberbatch and Michael Fassbender, there's so much rich pathology there, in a sense, from all of them, particularly Fassbender, in a way, of just how toxic it is, this whole situation is, not only obviously for the slaves, but also but the people who are committing this evil and know it.
And I think that cold touch, I think, is crucial for these extreme subject matters when you think about the stories he's told so far. I mean, something like shame with sex addiction. I mean, it, you get anyone who's going to play that up in any real way, and I think you're going to overdo it or even deflate it or undermine it, and somehow that coldness, that distance, it does serve at least this story really well.
I'm not sure cold is the right word.
It didn't feel as clinical or as detached to me as some seem to think.
Seeing is wrecking. It's causing havoc within you, but it's not in the way we're used to. I think that's why cold comes to mind, because we're not being throttled by it,
like
other movies might do with this subject.
But think about when he goes for the long take, when he really nails that camera to the floor. It's during the film's most brutal scenes, you know.
Yeah, true enough.
You know, and that, I think that's a Hanukkah level clinical touch.
It is. It is. It almost throws you out of the film, but there's something about it that actually does the opposite.
No, I think it's really effective.
Yeah,
don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
My number two film of the year. Well, we'll have one of our friends here on the show make that pick.
Hello, Adam and Josh and Film Spotting listeners. This is Steve Procopi, otherwise known as Capone from Ain't It Cool News, with my choice for my number one film of 2013. Very often when I narrow my list down to maybe two or three titles, I often go with the one that I found more viscerally stimulating rather than perhaps intellectually stimulating. And this year is definitely the choice. My choice would be Spike Jonze's latest Her, starring Joaquin Phoenix as a man who falls in love with his operating system, voiced by Scarlett Johansson, so who wouldn't? It's a full-blown science fiction love story for sure, but it also deconstructs the elements of a love story and a relationship and considers the possibility that maybe relationships would be easier on us if one of the parties involved wasn't a flawed, unstable human being. Of course, there are problems with this theory, and having an artificial intelligence for a companion leads to a whole set of new problems. But it's also kind of wonderful the way it's executed here by Spike, with a very heavy emotional component, but also a lot of fun. And what starts out as something kind of cute is built upon and grows into something that I think resembles perfection. And so once again, my heart wins over my head. And I can't wait to see what you guys come up with. So hopefully we'll see you soon. And thanks for asking me to contribute. Bye.
We're planning to give her a fuller review here on the show in the next week or so. It opens Christmas Day. For now, I'll just say I agree with Steve's comments largely, and Josh and listeners know how I feel about Scarlett Johansson's performance as the operating system Samantha in this movie. She was my number two surprise of the year because she's an actress I've always had issues with on screen. I think she's just remarkable here as the voice of Samantha. I'm also a fan of Joaquin Phoenix's really understated performance, Hoyt Van Hoytema's cinematography, everything about this near future world that Spike Jonze creates really, really drew me in. And I think that is saying something when we have to accept a world where a man and an operating system could have a serious, genuine conversation about their validity of their feelings for each other and the capacity for their feelings. I think that really does speak to the magic that Spike Jonze pulls off with this movie. I also think it's Spike Jonze's best film, and I've liked all of his previous films quite a bit. As I was getting here through my list and had come up with these nine picks, I realized that I don't really have a grand unifying theme this year. I tend to try to do that. Last year with 2012, it was all about Data and The Signal and The Noise, and we've touched a little bit on the American Dream stuff that popped up. Maybe this isn't a theme, it's just more of a coincidence, but I did notice that six of my 10 picks for best films of the year all revolve around characters dealing with marital issues or divorce is in their past, and I don't know if that speaks to something that's resonating with me. Hey, I seem to be doing fine with my wife, for the record. But you know, maybe it's something that speaks to something else that is going on culturally. I'm not sure, but that was something this year that at least six very good films dealt with on screen, and hers another one that does really get into that, where you have a character in the one played by Joaquin Phoenix who is really wrecked by a trauma from his past as he's trying to recover from that and gets into this relationship with the operating system. It's a movie I did not expect to have that strong of a reaction. You talk about cold and clinical. You think a movie that's this brainy and has this type of high concept just should not be as powerful as it is, but it's human in every way. So her is my number two pick.
And it's my number one pick.
Really?
Yep. Yep, it was. I think Spike Jonze is a true comic poet, and I think this film is beguiling without being sentimental. And I think you know, you've hit a good point about this. It's just the aspect of it that really is just about you know, how this sort of forlorn, isolated guy has to kind of learn how to just sort of kind of deprogram and process through the not particularly dramatic wreckage of a failed relationship. I mean, there isn't really a big dark secret to why anything went down. It's not even a matter. It's just a matter that he's dragging it around. And this is, I think what's amazing about the film really for me is that it is perched just perfectly between kind of a wonderment at this technological possibility that we would have, say, in 20, 30 years' time, the movie's not specifying a specific year, but that we would be in the situation where we could find an intuitively programmed life partner who just happens to be a voice. The wonderment of that, and yet sort of the chilling implications of that, you're right down the middle in this movie. And I talked to Jonze at a Q&A screening here a couple weeks ago, and the audience was hilarious. They were right down the middle, too. I mean, half the people thought it was just kind of this really sweet, disarming, inventive science fiction comedy, and the other half thought it was more frightening than The Lord of the Flies, you know, or Hunger Games. It was like for them it was like dystopian plus. And the movie's kind of, in a very delicate way, kind of saying, yeah, it could be a little of both.
Earlier I was thinking about how I was annoyed, and this is going to sound strange, but I was really excited about that. And then I was thinking about the other things I've been feeling, and I caught myself feeling proud of that, you know, proud of having my own feelings about the world, like the times I was worried about you, and things that hurt me, things I want. And then I had this terrible thought. Like, are these feelings even real? Or are they just programming? And that idea really hurts.
I think we're just going to go ahead and do the wave here, because my number one movie of the year is also Her.
All right.
Don't worry. Josh is going to ruin it.
Okay. Well, yeah, I don't know. You know, I've been looking for as great as this year has been, I'd been looking for one movie to sort of just bring order to the universe and be kind of the movie of the times.
Yeah, that's what
and
it
this
is.
Was it. It is so much the 21st century love story. It's one of those science fiction movies that do what great science fiction movies do, which is to take something that happens in the future, or in this case, I think the near future, and completely capture the tenor of the time we live in now, where we're so close, where we have such an intimate relationship with our gadgets, and it taps into that feeling that we need to control and possess people, that they can be, we can adjust the user settings to our satisfaction. And the way that this relationship develops between Theodore, played by Joaquin Phoenix, and Samantha, it's one of those things that where it starts out as a reflection of his narcissism, in a way, of a system that kind of builds itself around him and is so complementary to him. And then it becomes an actual relationship where the other person, or the other thing in this case, has needs and is evolving. And that is what happens when to relationships. People change, and sometimes they change and they drift. And I don't know. I adore this film. I think it's incredibly moving. It's really funny.
Yeah. Hear.
It's audacious. It is just towering above a year full of films that I love. So.
Right.
Well, I don't have Her as my number one, but not because I have any significant problems with it. We can hopefully dig into that. That's the plan in an upcoming show here, Adam, and talk about it in a little more detail. My number one instead is Leviathan, actually, the immersive documentary set on this commercial fishing ship. And it was just a transporting experience for me. It really was. I didn't know where I was, what I was hearing, what I was seeing for a lot of the time. But I was okay with that. It was something like the way it used sound, image, light, and motion. It was this, it's a sensory amplification chamber. I can't think of another time where I was getting to be so attuned to those elements. Mm-hmm. And instead of that growing wearying for me, I just started to see these as, you know, the building blocks of cinema itself. And the movie is very modest, I think. It's not, people have been reading into it certain themes, I'm sure it's open to that. But really, at the most basic level, it's this modest construction of the elements of cinema. And it was just a real ride to be immersed in that for a while.
Yeah, a movie I can appreciate so much about, but just never connected with me the way it did for you. I think it's one of those.
It was my 11, so it was right there.
Really?
But it was another example of documentary play. I mean, talk about playing with form. My goodness. I mean, this is like Gravity, basically. I mean, this is an experience to watch this film, and if you're engaged in that experience, it's really powerful. You know, it's like what's the name of that television show where they're fishing for Alaskan crab?
Right. Oh, we see
it. I know what you mean.
The Deadliest Catch?
Yes. Yeah.
Is that what it's called?
Basically, this is like the Deadliest Catch as it was directed by Gaspar Noé would be my way of thinking about it. But I do love it. And it's about a different kind of information that you get from documentaries, because you don't really learn anything about these guys. You don't learn anything
Nothing
about the
practical.
Business. But what you do learn is what it is like to be tossed and turned in the sheer viscera of the job. And it was almost like being in the aquatic equivalent of like a early 20th century industrial hell, basically. And I love it. It's a great pick.
And I haven't seen it. I haven't seen the movie.
Oh, my gosh.
Never. That's not supposed to happen. We're supposed to not see the ones you bring to the table.
No, that and the Wind Rises. I just, for whatever reason, you know, scheduling. Yeah.
Well, here we are. We're at the final pick, the final number one pick here as we do our annual roundtable. And you know what, guys? I was almost completely in lockstep with you, Scott, and with you, Michael, with the Spike Jonze film Her being my number one. And actually, up until just a few days ago, it had been my number one for two or 3 weeks. But there was this other movie that was number two, and it just kept lingering and lingering in my mind. And I finally just had to say, you know what? Yes, it's my number one. It's bumping her down a little bit. And I wish I had a more surprising pick, but it's the Coen Brothers. It's Inside Llewyn Davis. It's my favorite film of the year.
It's that music. You just can't listen into the soundtrack.
It might be. And you know what? Again, we have said this multiple times. It's another one we are hoping to review in some detail next week. So I'll be vague here. It just opened this weekend here in Chicago. I think it's a Coen Brothers movie in every way. And that, for me, is a very good thing. The tone, the great writing and acting. Thematically, I love, Michael, the phrase you used when it came up. It was in your 6 through 10, correct? Death haunted. And that's something thematically that I do think is a key part of their work, something I definitely want to touch on further. I saw it on the big screen, but I have the screener at home as well. And even though I think you could describe it as bleak, you use that word, Josh, it's not an uplifting film. It's pretty depressing. That said, I found myself over the past 2 weeks, if I'm just working on my computer and I need something on in the background, I'll just put it on. I'll put the DVD in and just have Inside Llewyn Davis going on in the background. And yes, the music's part of it, but it's not wall-to-wall music by any means. It's also just to hear the characters and hear that dialogue and to go back and revisit this world. For whatever reason, it just keeps drawing me back to it. And I also think that that Llewyn Davis character is just such an interesting conundrum. And that really comes through in the performance of Oscar Isaac, an incredibly talented actor. We've sung his praises for other performances over the years here on the show. To now see him get that vehicle to really showcase his talents is something I was really happy to see. So I'm with a lot of other critics on this one, I guess. Inside Llewyn Davis is not just one of the best films of the year. It is, for me, the best film of 2013. And those are our top 10 films of the year. What about any honorable mentions, guys? I think I'm going to hold off. Josh, we might post these on our website, but for the people here in Michael and Scott who aren't regulars necessarily here on the show every week, we'd love to hear some of your choices.
I mean, the group of 30 for me included stuff we've already talked about: Beyond the Hills, Blue is the Warmest Color, Computer Chess, The Conjuring. Francis Ha we didn't talk about. And,
yeah, wow, that's remarkable.
It was
12 on my list.
No one
again,
had Gravity
so.
Either.
And as mentioned, Gravity's in there. Stunning. Give me the loot. The La Grande Bellezza, otherwise known as The Great Beauty, is a film from Paolo Sorrentino, which I like very much, and it's got my favorite actor in the world, Tony Servillo, in it. Great. In a World, the Lake Bell comedy. That's one of the best comedies of the year.
It's a good movie.
You know, Much Ado About Nothing, Mud, I'm glad we mentioned. Museum Hours. Any love for Museum Hours?
Might
here?
Be my number 11.
Yeah, good.
Yeah.
Loved it.
Really big fan.
Loved it. You know, The Place Beyond the Pines, there's a messy movie, Scott, that I think really says to hell with it.
The first third is one of my favorites of the year.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, no, I went for the whole thing. Yeah. And, you know, This is the End and The World's End, 20 Feet from Stardom.
Yeah, good
yeah,
doc.
Yeah, all yeah. right, that's it. Enough.
Scott, what about you?
So many. One that I've kind of mentioned offhand certain things that have made my top 15. One I didn't mention was The Past, which is the new film by Asghar Farhadi.
One of my regrets that I haven't caught up with yet.
And it's so much the same. I mean, they could be companion films for sure. Just exquisitely wrought, beautiful. You know, he's a director who can take a simple situation and just look at it from so many different angles. And the performances are incredible. A Touch of Sin.
That was also in my top three.
Zhu Zhangqi is sort of a look at violence, four-pronged look at violence. Kind of a change of pace for him. I thought that was pretty great. I think A Hijacking is an interesting movie. If you've seen a Captain Phillips, this is the other Somali hijacking movie, and it's one that kind of takes it from the angle of corporate negotiation, and I think it's really clever. All is Lost, which I'm really surprised didn't make more lists. It's just pure. It's just a pure survival tale. Again, very well done. And I'm a big fan of the film Drug War.
Yes, I am too.
By Johnny Toe, who is, you know, one of the best action filmmakers in the world, and just I think it's pretty top drawer even by his standards. But he just routinely turns out just impeccably directed action films, and this is one of them. And I also kind of want to put in a good word for Bastards by Claire Denis, who's one of my favorite filmmakers. It's a really tough film. It may be her darkest film, which is saying something, but it's her kind of her take on noir, but it's so much something of hers. So those are just some of the many.
Well, Drug War, the Johnny Toe film you mentioned, along with Museum Hours, two of the films definitely in my 11 through 20. We will list those 11 through 20 picks if I can convince Josh to share his as well.
Yeah, I got
them. FilmSpotting.net. We want to know your picks. Send us your choices for the best films of 2013. Email us feedback@filmspotting.net.
You can also leave us a voicemail, 312-264-0744, or find us on Twitter at FilmSpotting and at facebook.com/FilmSpotting.
Out in wide release this weekend, the samurai movie 47 Ronin. It stars Keanu Reeves. He is out to avenge his murdered master. Have you guys seen this one yet?
No, but I mean, this is
playing keep away.
You don't want, you don't want to review the budget, but the budget was something like $200 million or something on this.
I mean, I don't know.
Well, there are 47 Ronin.
There's 47 Ronin.
That's a lot of Ronin
for sure.
But how many assassins were there in the Takashi Miike film?
That's a good point.
Yeah.
I should actually know, but yeah, I financed that film.
Yet another one. Yeah. Grudge match, De Niro and Stallone giving us what we always wanted, Rocky Balboa versus Jake LaMotta. The Secret Life of Walter Mitty is out. Josh, it was your number one most anticipated movie of the year, and as we learned last year, your number one disappointment.
How about that?
Wow. The Wolf of Wall Street also out. The divisive The Wolf of Wall Street here over the course of our two-part film spotting top 10 show. Out in limited release, opening in Chicago this weekend, Mandela, Long Walk to Freedom, which does star Idris Elba, and Her, Spike Jonze's film. It is, according to Michael and Scott, the best film of the year. For me, just the second best film of the year. Sorry, I guess I just have too much love for the Coen brothers, but you could do a lot worse if you were looking to see a movie this weekend than the new film from Spike Jonze. Next week here on Film Spotting, for our radio listeners, we're going to revisit our 2012 Sacred Cow discussion with the Grinch, Michael Phillips, who doesn't fully appreciate Raiders of the Lost Ark. You can hear that show. We need to, you know, give people shows where they appreciate from time to time what Josh and I bring.
Every once in a while.
Every once in a while. So, Michael, that's what that's there for. We'll also revisit that top five from that show, our favorite films from the year 1981. On the podcast side, we will offer a film spotting fix. We will get into Inside Llewyn Davis from the Coen brothers and Spike Jonze's Her.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths, and special thanks to everyone at Chicago Public Media. Chicago Public Media creates award-winning content about the issues that affect our community, our nation, and our world. More information is available at chicagopublicmedia.org. And the music that was taken from some of the best soundtracks of the year was curated by Sam Smith. You can see some of his design work at samsmith.net. And also, you guys, Michael and Scott, where can we find your work? We want to thank you again for enlivening the conversation. If people want to read what you said further about some of these films, where should they go?
ChicagoTribune.com/movies.
TheDissolve.com.
Excellent. Thanks again for Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.